You are now listening to the 9th episode of Jughead's Basement.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control.
The wiki page, which is sometimes it's true and sometimes it has, you know, falsities. But I wanted to see your reaction to this. The lineup of Portman, Reader, and Pittman became the band's most stable lineup since 1988, lasting 4 years. That's his unquote. Now, in the time frame of many bands, this doesn't appear to be a long time, but with many pop punk lead vocals and writers, this is quite a bit of time. Why did the band stay constant for those 4 years?
You know, it was working tolerably well for a while there. Not just because of what we were doing, but because of that was the time when so-called pop punk was the most popular pop music in the country and later the world. You know, so there was more of a constituency for what we were doing. And by that point, you know, we were trying to do it as a full-time, I wouldn't say professional, but as a full-time thing. And, you know, the band, they go as long as there's oxygen sometimes, and that's kind of what it was like. 95 through, you know, 98 or so, those were years of comparative milk and honey in small-time touring punk rock band world.
You get into my headache. You regulate.
You just heard from Frank Portman, better known as Dr. Frank, from the band The Mr. T Experience. Formed in 1985 on the UIC campus in Berkeley, California, this was pre-Gilman Street, pre-Lookout Records, and pre-Screeching Weasel. In fact, Ben and I would listen to this very song often before our first rehearsals as the band to become Screeching Weasel, known as All Night Garage Sale. In 2003, with 9 full-length records and a few EPs under their belt, and around 9 band members here and gone, the Mr. T Experience, also known as MTX, released their 10th and last record, Yesterday Rules, in 2003. Right now, you are listening to a song called Sheep from the first record entitled Everyone's Entitled to Their Own Opinion. This podcast will center on their 6th full-length record called Love is Dead, released in 1996 on Lookout Records during the peak of the first wave pop-punk movement. Besides fragments of all the songs on the record, you will also hear interviews of the 3 band members who performed on Love is Dead, Dr. Frank, Jim Pittman, and Joel Reeder. In addition to the aforementioned, you will hear from producer-engineer Kevin Army and Lookout Records representative Christopher Applegren. And in addition to the additions, you will hear personal pieces in relation to Love is Dead, written by my 2 friends, Evan Hanover and Michael T. Fournier. So with less further ado, Love is Dead.
I don't want to be a sheep.
Number 1 is Sackcloth and Ashes.
Well, that is, I think that's one of the better songs I ever came up with. And I think it's a kind of an unusual, generalized, sort of extended metaphor, the penitence, in biblical penitence. To apply to a romantic love song situation. But there's a way where you can do that where the gags are superficial, and I've certainly done my share of those. But then there is a way that it can be executed where it illuminates the emotional content in a way that is organic, or that comes off as that. And that's what I think ultimately the real memorable songs that you do are. And I think that, you know, for whatever reason, it really worked on that one. And it's just an unusual thing to try to do all around, and, you know, sometimes you get lucky and it works.
Just the nuts and bolts, where were you born and raised?
Born in San Francisco, raised, mostly, on the peninsula, which is just south. To the suburbs, for the south of the city.
You look good on paper too, when actually you're not. She's not looking anymore for someone to be.
What influenced you to pick up an instrument, and were these the same influences that led you to starting a band?
My dad had a guitar that was an old Spanish guitar, and I used to play around with that. And I would say what made me decide to try to pretend to be a rock star when I was picking it up was when I started listening to the radio. And there were a lot of college stations in the Bay Area that played punk rock and, I suppose, kind of the music that, they didn't use the word alternative then, but the alternative to what was on the regular radio. And that kind of got me interested. So then I would hear these bands, I'd make cassette tapes of them, and then I'd try to learn to play them and make up my own versions of those songs that I recorded from the radio and play them on my dad's Spanish guitar until the guitar was destroyed by my hitting it constantly. It was in several pieces until the end of that period. She's got pretty fake eyelashes, slanted plastic glasses. Everyone who passes says she looks... You know, I was 12, 13, talking 76, 77. And, you know, so it was mostly the punk rock of 1977, mostly British. And that's just not my interest. That was what those guys were on the college radio DJs around here tended to play, the Adverts and the Buzzcocks, the Damned, and that sort of thing. That was my main area of interest at that time. I think you talk to a lot of people, and whether it's true or not, they like to present themselves as 100% purists. Well, I discovered punk rock, and that's all I ever listened to. That wasn't the case with me, but that was the most interesting thing on the radio, so that's what I gravitated towards. But she's got pretty party dresses.
We've all experienced sort of the difference between what interests us in music, but ultimately that's usually not what actually makes you pick up an instrument. I mean, Nick and Reagan, they were all like metal fans, but when they heard punk rock, the early punk rock, that's what actually made them think they could pick up an instrument, you know?
I would say for me, it was a bit of a subversion of that. The usual story that people say is, hey, and these are just regular people, and they didn't have any talent or any instruments, and they could still do it. And that's definitely the case, obviously. But it was also that probably if it had been harder to do, I would have, like so many things that were hard, I would have just let it go. One day maybe you'll be ready. I'm the silly habit you put on. But since it was kind of easy to sound like you sort of sounded like those guys, sort of in your head maybe, it's deceptively simple because actually executing it is a lot harder than it seems like it would be, as it turns out. But yeah, I learned how to play some chords, and you didn't really have to know how to do it that well, and you didn't have to worry about technique too much. But at this point, we're talking about it just all in my bedroom. So, you know, it was only me with the audience. So, and I was pretty easy to please, unfortunately. Sackcloth and ashes, sackcloth and ashes, sackcloth and ashes, they're never gonna
understand. Frank, why the name Mr. T?
Well, it's shrouded in history. My best guess is what happened is that all these times when groups of guys that I was playing with decided to do some sort of performance and we needed to come up with a name to put on the flyer, that was just one of those times. And it is very possible that the only explanation for it was that the A-Team happened to be on TV at the time and we were drunk enough to think, hey, this is a good idea. And so we made a flyer and it seemed funny. So we went ahead and did it. But then subsequently to that, we came up with various after the fact rationalizations for it that I don't think are that interesting to repeat. I never thought, obviously, never imagined I would have to be accounting for it 30 years later. I mean, that's insane, really.
Later in the band, you start using MTX more often. Is that in some ways trying to get away from that?
Well, I don't know about trying to get away from that because I always felt you'd never fool anyone.
Yeah, I agree.
There are a lot of bands that people get tired of them, they change the name, and that doesn't last too long. So it wasn't like that. Actually, MTX was, from the beginning, was what we called it. And it was supposed to be funny. You know, it was like all the three initial bands.
Right.
Almost everything we did was some kind of mockery of something else. And sort of for better or worse, the original that the thing was the mockery of was not always clear to people. But there's so many of these brilliant jokes we came up with or brilliant parodies that we would realize later, oh, no one gets it because they don't know what that thing is. That's kind of an example of it. Now no one knows. It's very hard to explain. At some point, the stupidity of the band name kind of became part of the whole thing. It wouldn't have been honest to pretend that that wasn't the case, and it would have taken a lot of effort, so we just went with it.
Joel, tell us about Ba Ba Ba.
The hit. This was a song that we learned pretty shortly after I joined the band. I recall, I think it was our second or third show ever that I played with the band in Sacramento at the old Cattle Club. We played the song, and it connected with audiences right from the beginning. It's just got the perfect tempo for pogoing, and you could just tell it was going to be a staple of our sets from then on. Now, I don't think that there was a single show we played after that time where we didn't play it. So even to this day, I think there's probably no song that I've performed as many times as Ba 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 Ba. The original working title was The Little Things, which is a lyric from that song. And I think Frank only changed it because that god-awful Bush song, The Little Things, was on the radio and became a big modern rock hit right around the same time that he composed that and first brought it to the band.
My name is Michael T. Fournier. This is track 2, Ba 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 Ba. I thought the Mr. T Experience were pretty good for a novelty band. Up at the University of New Hampshire, everybody played that one song on their radio show.
I still haven't found a girlfriend, though I've tried a lot.
Even Hitler had a girlfriend. And it was cute, and it was quirky, and it was really hard to take that band seriously. And it was still really hard to take that band seriously after I saw them the first time.
My life till now has been filled with doubt. Here I am, cause there's no other place I can go.
Headlining a 3-band bill in the middle of summer at the Elvis Room in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Of course, the first band on that bill was the Riverdales. So there's 300 people in a 100-person room, packed to the gills, covered with sweat, while Ben and the rest of those guys played all their Ramones-sounding songs, talking about going to Hampton Beach after the show. The crowd freaked out. Probably 100 people left, so there were 200 people in a 100-person room to see the middle band, Boris the Sprinkler. Reverend Norb's knuckles were just inches from the ceiling fan spinning above his head while he stood on a milk crate with his antler helmet on, wearing spandex, playing strip state capitals. Amazing. Of course, I sweated out all my bodily fluids and I was rehydrating at the bar when the Mr. T Experience played. Then the next time they came through Portsmouth, they also headlined a 3-band bill. The first band that time was called The Burls. They were these little teenagers from Newmarket, New Hampshire. They had songs called Anarchy and Newmarket, Sexual Anarchy, Spankathon. You probably get the idea. The Burls do get the footnote, though, because their drummer was Rick Orcutt, who now plays drums in The Guts. You can spell it B-U-R-L-S if you want to Google it. My buddy Christian Sager, who's now a comic book author, joined the Burls and played guitar for that show and then quit. So he could say he played with the Mr. T Experience and Doc Hopper, the middle band. That's right. Chris Pierce was in that band. He was in the AGs, who were one of New Hampshire's finest musical exports. Then he was in Sinkhole. And then he was in Doc Hopper as well. I probably saw them like 20 times and I was psyched. It was a little bit less hot at that show. So instead of going to the bar to rehydrate, I wound up catching the Mr. T Experience. And yeah, they introduced most of their songs by saying,
"This is a song about a girl. 1, 2, 3,
go!
Ba, 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 ba."
Oh, goddamn, man. Ba, 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 ba. First listen. That song has always stuck with me. First listen. Not many songs like that that just stick to you like glue. So then I thought to myself, maybe I'm being a little harsh here. maybe this is more than a novelty band. And I went back and I listened to their catalog. God damn it, I should have paid more attention that first time. This was not a novelty band. They're way better than that. But you know this. And so does my cat, Molly, who's sitting right here. Come on, Molly.
Joel, where were you born?
Born and raised in California on the central coast about an hour or 2 hours south of the Bay Area. And grew up in a little agricultural community in the Santa Cruz County. Just a stone's throw, geographically speaking, from the San Francisco Bay Area, but it felt like a world away.
Track 3, I Just Want to Do It With You.
This is a fun one. Live, we worked out a routine where Frank and I would point at members of the audience right when we got to the end of the chorus and sang that we just wanted to do it with them. And it was totally shameless, but really fun. Oh, also, that song has the line where the band drops out and Frank sings, "We're so far apart and the trouble is that I can't take Bart out to where you live." And that line turned out to be pretty confusing for people who weren't from the Bay Area and didn't realize he was referring to the Bay Area Rapid Transit train, which is our version of the subway. One fan, at least, thought that he had constructed a whole narrative in his mind where Bart was the child that he shared with the woman in the song and they shared custody and he couldn't bring their son Bart to visit her because they lived so because of the distance between them. Go! Because we're such a good couple, but you're so far away. What you are is the best, and nothing less than my one. I wanna waste the rest of my whole life with. Yes, indeed, guaranteed to everything I'll ever need. I'm wasting my life away, and I know I'll be sorry one day. But all I ever wanted to do is this, and have someone to waste it with. Oh, anything you wanna do. I didn't have much of a choice in the matter at first. My parents started me playing classical music before I can even remember. I think I was 3 or 4 years old when they put a quarter-sized cello in my hands and had me start taking lessons. And I did that dutifully for years and years. I was decent, but I never had a passion for it. And then many years later, I discovered rock and roll music on my own. We didn't grow up with rock and roll records in the house or anything. And the first band that really captured my imagination, like a lot of people's, was the Beatles. You know, so it's decades later, but they still have this impact on new generations all the time. So I was just fascinated by them. And I realized it had always been a chore for me to have to endure cello lessons and recitals and youth symphonies and orchestras. But when I saw how much fun it could be to make music that way, that's all I wanted to do. So I put down the cello and picked up a bass because it had 4 strings also. And it seemed like it would be the easiest transition. And I would go to the public library every day after school and Xerox a different Beatles song out of this giant book of sheet music they had there. And I'd learn one every day. I just wanna do it with you. I'm not a cool dude. I
don't have a tattoo or a big Cadillac or a backwards bass. Was this what first got into a band?
I knew I wanted to be in a band pretty much as soon as I discovered what one was, but it wasn't really part of my reality. I grew up sort of in the sticks a little bit. I didn't have any close neighbors. No one in my high school was interested in rock and roll music. So I pretty much it only existed in my head. I would practice alone in my room playing along to records for years and imagined what it would be like to be in a group and came up with fake band names and artwork, but it didn't become a reality until I was a senior in high school and I joined my first band. So far apart, and the trouble is that I can't take Bart out to where you live. Which coincidentally happened to be the Mr. T Experience, actually.
Was Mr. T then your first band?
It was. It was sort of, if you will forgive the whimsical comparison, it was a sort of Cinderella story with a little bit of a punk rock element.
Let's see if this question fits in for that story to come out. If not, then you can just tell it anyway. Who did you meet first in Mr. T Experience, and what were the circumstances of this introduction?
It does tie in.
Good.
I met Dr. Frank first. I can tell you the whole story about how I came to be familiar with the music of the Mr. T Experience too.
Yeah.
So even though there was no punk rock music scene in my hometown, I had older sisters, one of whom went to UC Berkeley and brought back punk rock records every time she visited home. She was the one who introduced me to Green Day and Operation Ivy and MTX and all those Lookout records. And I don't know if it was the fact that it was all sort of right in my backyard or something else that appealed to me about it, but I latched on to that sensibility, and those were the first albums that really spoke to me and made me feel like I was a part of a scene. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't wait to graduate high school and move 2 hours north and go to Berkeley myself. And I took a campus visit my senior year of high school and went and stayed with my sister. And we went to my first ever show at 924 Gilman Street, which is the famous Ollie's punk rock club there in the East Bay. And it just so happened that Dr. Frank was in attendance in the audience, and I recognized him, and I was sort of starstruck, and it worked up the nerve finally to approach him. And I asked him what was going on with the band, because I hadn't seen them being too active lately. I asked if they'd broken up. He said they hadn't, but that their bass player had quit to join Sam I Am, and they couldn't seem to find a replacement, and he didn't suppose I knew somebody who played. And this light bulb went off over my head, and I said, I play bass. And then that's when he looked at me and asked how old I was, and I said, I'm 17. And I don't think that it would have progressed any further than that, because he was 13 years older than me at the time. Well, he still is. And I don't think that he was quite desperate enough that he would have given me his phone number then and there. But I just so happened to have pulled a flyer off a telephone pole I'd seen in Berkeley earlier in the day that said, pop punk band seeks bass player. We sound rather like the Mr. T Experience. And I thought, this is perfect. Maybe I'll, you know, connect with some of these guys when I'm going to school here next year. Maybe we can play together. But it turned out it was, that was the flyer that MTX had put up, because when they put up a flyer that said, Mr. T Experience seeks bass player, no one had answered it. So they put up, we sound like the Mr. T Experience, and I guess they did slightly better. But so their phone numbers were on this flyer, and I had it in my pocket, and I pulled it out. So this isn't you, is it? He said, oh, it is. So I followed up, and I don't know if they just didn't have the heart to turn me away, but they let me audition, and it went well enough that I kept playing with them. And then before I knew it, a few months later, I was officially a member of my favorite band.
By officially, how do you mean? Did Dr. Frank actually say you are in, or that just sort of you were just happened to be there every day? And
Frank isn't much for standing on ceremony, so there was no rite of passage or anything. It was one day. It was like, well, let's see how this goes. You can come to the next practice and the one after that, and then everyone just over time gradually started referring to me as if it was taken for granted that I was in equal standing as everyone else. But that would have been nice if maybe I'd gotten some kind of plaque.
His sister was my age or so at UC Berkeley, and she had taken him to shows when he was a kid, and then he was, you know, still a kid, but a little older kid, and he would know better. I don't know how it actually happened myself. I just remember that we wanted to keep doing stuff, and Aaron had left to play in Sam I Am, so we tried out a couple of other bass players, and that didn't really seem to work that well. And, you know, whatever else Joel brought to the table, he had sort of boundless enthusiasm. So we kind of went with it. We tried out a few recordings just to see, and, you know, it didn't suck. So there you go.
Yeah, he had said he never really was asked officially to be in the band. He just started showing up to the rehearsals, and then you started touring and you started recording.
Well, it's funny, because I remember when we did a practice with Joel, and his sister Nicole was there, and like there was after we finished or like in a break or something, so she said, so are you going to make my little brother's dreams come true and ask him to be in your band? And it was like a very long uncomfortable silence that has lasted to this day. But there came a time when if he was going to keep doing it, he had to make some decisions, like, you know, what he's going to do with his life. And so, you know, it was working well enough that I don't recall a specific, you know, it wasn't like Morris, where I presented him with a certificate saying, you are now a member of the band, arise, Sir Joel. It wasn't like that, but somehow it wound up that it was a lineup that was going to keep going for a little while.
Number four is Somebody's Song, which the lyrics are by Dorothy Parker, New York writer.
Yes, so that's an unusual one as well. As far as I know, that's the only time where Frank wrote a song around someone else's words. And so it was sort of experimental. And I think the resulting song ends up being just a little bit offbeat for us because of that. But they're amazing lyrics. So Dorothy Parker's estate had donated all of the royalties from her written works to the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So Frank had to get permission from them before we could release the song. So that was a little bit of a hurdle. Well, I don't think we ever played that song live, if I'm not mistaken. But it remains sort of a unique and fun curiosity in the catalog of the band.
This is one of the few of lyrics from somebody else, Dorothy Parker, somebody's song.
Right. I mean, that kind of shows where my head was at with regard to artistic pretensions. I mean, that was a pretty pretentious thing to do. There are two songs that were later than The Batch, than the other ones, and there was somebody's song and also You're the Only One, which were kind of written close to when the album was being done. And they reflected my personal issues at the time and honestly, some of the stuff that caused the album to sound the way it does and come out the way it does, you know, the influence of selection of those, doing those two things. But it's a terrific lyric. I think a lot of her lyrics would make pretty great songs. And that was just my shot at doing it, even though I've, you know, fully admit that it was kind of cheesy and pretentious to do it. But in the context, It doesn't come off that way because of how mundane the rest of the, or at least on the seemingly mundane the rest of it is. So it's like it's just a little detour lyrically.
Number five, Thank You for Not Being One of Them. This recently is one of my favorites now, though.
Yeah, it definitely strikes a chord. It was one of, you know, sort of not as a comment on the recording of the song or anything, but there's a handful of songs that formed the germ of the narrative voice and the attitude that I was later to use when I wrote King Dork.
For those of you who are not in the know, Frank Portman, Dr. Frank, is also a novelist. He wrote a book called King Dork, which is a young adult novel. It was first published in 2006. While I was conducting these interviews with him, he was just finishing the editing on his upcoming third novel.
And that's one of the songs that that kind of was the stepping stone into that. It's funny to be 30 years old and, you know, writing about being bullied in high school, but a lot of people have done it, and that was my version of it. I think you can extend the mindset to, as so many things in high school, you can extend the experience of the mindset to other things that happen to you as your life goes on. One of the more popular ones, and I guess I can kind of see why.
I am Evan Hanover, and this is track 5. Thank you for not being one of them. Mr. T Experience was pretty much the soundtrack to my prolonged adolescence. I should clarify a little, because not all adolescences are prolonged the same. Emotional, social, and financial stuntings, they come in many flavors, and they're betrayed by many, many different symptoms. One person might use monetary slovenliness, another eschews sanitation in favor of a video game addiction. They're all just ways to defer the choices of adulthood, and the choices that adulthood kind of cut us off from. For me, it was about girls. And I don't mean that it was about girls in some kind of reckless, running around, oat-sowing way. It was more about missed opportunities. Specifically, I had a profound longing to be nostalgic about those times, which I never had, when I was nurtured by hopelessly innocent and emotionally precocious relationships. Relationships from my teens, which I reiterate I basically didn't have because I was busy being a misanthrope who was mercilessly free of those twin albatrosses, self-esteem and fashion sense. Day by day. So So, enter Dr. Frank and Company. Appropriately, I came across them in about 1995. I was in college and had just turned 20. I was becoming aware that I'd really underachieved in really key areas of my teens. When was I going to make puppy love promises that were laughably untenable? Where were my dopey decisions, which only seemed monumental through the lens of the very stupidity that birthed them? Never and nowhere. That's where they were. And that panicked me. Albums like Milk Milk Lemonade and Our Bodies Ourselves by the Mr. T Experience. In those I saw a chance to not so much live vicariously as to have lived vicariously. I'll be your codependent, you're my cute little enabler. That is pubescent gold. And what 20-year-old doesn't want to look forward to being a 38-year-old, wistfully looking back on the moronically earnest things their 18-year-old self said? At least, that's the brilliant way I saw it. Thank You for Not Being One of Them had everything I would have wanted to remember my non-existent teenage romances having, had they happened. We've got a boy and a girl. They're in junior high school or high school. It doesn't matter. I don't know. And they're in love and couldn't be more delighted or surprised by it. Or at least the less mature boy seems really delighted and surprised by it. He's bullied. We don't know why. But we know that she doesn't care about whatever those reasons are. She understands him. Or he thinks that she understands him. And he understands that she understands them. Or thinks that he understands that she understands them. But these bullies, they are a common enemy, and it's boy and girl versus world, and they have a plan, and the thrill is in the making of it. The kids are having fun, proud of what they've done. Later that night, we'll hold each other tight and plot their destruction. Hey, hey, faggot, hey, cry baby cry. I hate them all, and I want them to die. You whisper to me sweet techniques we can murder them by. See what I mean?
Hey, hey, faggot, hey, cry baby cry.
Never mind that as a teen I was socially uneasy and awkward and didn't fit in and never was able to communicate really fluidly, but I never really got beaten up in any meaningful or habitual way. Still, this is something I really wanted to have. Some people have unresolved feelings from youth because they wanted their parents to hug or praise them more. I despaired that I missed out on the warmth and comfort of naive teen conspiracy, and yet here it was laid out for me to consume and wrap myself in.
When they've been.
And that's why, looking back, I have a deep, abiding love for those mid-90s Mr. T Experience albums. And even though I don't really listen to them often anymore, or relate to them in the same way, I don't think I need to, because nostalgia works. Even, and maybe especially, when it's invented and imagined.
Dumb Little Band.
Dumb Little Band could practically serve as an anthem for the Mr. T Experience. And the time when Frank wrote the lyrics to that, they really applied. We were not anywhere close to being a full-time, ongoing proposition. So everything in there about day jobs and playing to empty bars was 100% the truth. Later, when our fortunes had turned a little bit and we're playing to packed houses, the meaning behind it was still 100% honest. And that's one that still makes me smile thinking about it, because it's a perfect encapsulation of us against the world, which it often felt like. There's a couple of sly references in the lyrics to ex-bandmates. There's a part where he references the drummer quitting. Every year we self-destruct a bit, we break up when our drummer quits, and it that period in the song, sonically, Jim plays what's called a China Boy crash, which is this really obnoxious sounding cymbal that makes a noise like you're hitting a garbage can lid. It's sort of, I think it's like a, maybe more of a hardcore punk thing or a metal thing. It really cuts through. It's very grating. And one of Frank's biggest complaints about the former drummer is that he was in love with his China Boy and wanted to wail on it all the time. So that was a little bit of an inside joke. We had to go to a guitar center and purchase a China Boy crash on a credit card just to record those three hits. And then we returned it. Like, this wasn't exactly what we were looking for. Thanks anyway. And then the next line of the song, it says, the bass player quits. We talk him into doing one more show. Then the bass player quits and we break up again. And then I do my impression of the previous bass player who had these awesome thunderous arpeggios. So it goes right from the China Boy crashes into me doing my best. And of course, there's references in there to other bands, skyrocketing success, which was almost a little subgenre into itself back in those days. I remember Screeching Weasel had one, Our Friends Are Getting Famous. So, you know, bands like Green Day and Rancid becoming huge superstars ended up being good across the board for everyone in our line of work. You know, that success did trickle down to us at least a little bit, but you'd also, it was hard to resist sometimes grousing a little bit and being some sour grapes.
Where were you born and raised, Jim?
I was born in Whittier, California, which is a suburb, I think it's east of Los Angeles. I mean, like most kids, you know, just listening to rock music in the 70s, you know, and just kind of, the usual guys like Ringo and Charlie Watts and that sort of thing. And then once I got into metal, then it just got to be about Iron Maiden, UFO, Thin Lizzy, those kind of bands too, but that's kind of, you know, AC/DC and that sort of thing started me playing, you know, drums.
Did you actually play in metal bands?
I did. In high school, I started a metal band with my friend, who's actually in kind of a semi-successful metal band now called Machine Head. So we were like the two kids that knew about Metallica in the very, very early stages. There still is actually a kind of underground metal radio show in San Francisco here at the university. And, you know, this was 1982, I believe. But they, you know, this DJ used to play this really, really, you know, at least back then, very underground metal. So, like, the first incarnation of Exodus and all the new wave of British heavy metal stuff, too, that basically no one heard of back then. So listening to that station, just recording what I could at night, because the show didn't come on until 2 a.m. in the morning, it just opened my eyes to all this new stuff I had no idea about, too. And also punk rock as well, because you play that, so... You know, it was all very new to me, and that metal punk thing, once that took over, it consumed me. I just wanted to play in a metal band. And for probably the last 2 years I was in high school, we did that every weekend. We'd get a call from some girl saying, my parents are gone for the weekend. Come over, your band can play the party, and, you know, have a keg. And, you know, back then when people had house parties with bands and everything, you know.
Between 92 and 93, the band was pretty active, but also seemed to have gone through some major difficulties and lineup changes. You had already lost Byron earlier, and now John Bonham, and a bit later Alex. What kept you connected to the concept of the Mr. T experience? Why not another band or quitting and going back to school?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, playing in a band is fun, you know, so I wanted to keep doing it. At that point, there was a lot of misery involved, and you're talking about a lot of kind of not that wonderful shows and everything, but it was still pretty fun. And also, this was when I started, I wouldn't say that I, put it this way, I don't know if you could tell yet, but I was starting to pay more attention to what I was doing. And Kevin Army always said to sort of barely suppressed laughter on the part of pretty much everyone else, that the way to look at what my band was doing is, you know, that I was sort of this singer-songwriter in development, and maybe whether he planted that idea or whether he was right about that or whether I just was looking for something to make it more interesting, I started paying a little more attention to that end of things and didn't really want to cut it off. But then in the meantime, it's hard to keep the band together, especially a band that doesn't make any money for a long stretch of time. And so not only that, but it gets frustrating when you have these grandiose ideas or developing ever more grandiose and you don't have any kind of a budget to record them with. And so it was like this combination of artistic ambition and very frustrated, negative view of ever managing to make it come out all right. But, you know, every time there was a disaster you know, band member leaves, or there were several times when we arrived at the studio to find out that the minuscule budget had been reduced still further in the time that we got in the car to drive the studio by the time we got there. And so, you know, it's stuff like that. I'm a firm believer through all this experience that, you know, that the best thing to do when you have liabilities is to hold them up and make them work as well as you can. And they can almost become assets that way. At least they shape what you're doing in a way that it would not have happened if it were in the hands of others. And so I think you can look at it, I don't want to sound like a hippie, but you can kind of look back on it and see a sort of a logic to the way that all of these pitfalls and missteps and various troubles came about. And then on the split screen of that is we were doing shows and playing loud music, and that was more fun than the prospect of 10 years of graduate school for me. And so the idea of graduate school was put off until it didn't happen. And there was never any point where we thought, which might have been, you know, okay, we're going to like let this die and start something else, because we never thought it was going to really go anywhere. I just wanted to, you know, have these songs that I was getting better and better at, I felt, or I was trying to. I just wanted them to be presented in a form that worked, and, you know, not really thinking we got to make lots of money or sell lots of copies or anything, because that didn't seem even remotely possible. That would be a crazy idea. So, you know, why not just continue this project as it is, because it was better than what we would do if we stopped doing it.
Number 7, Hanging On To You.
Yeah, that was my attempt at doing a lyrically taking a 30s Tin Pan Alley type approach. I mean, I'm often in an ironic or even a spirit of mockery. I've been referred to as the Cole Porter of punk. They don't mean it in a nice way when they say it, but that's an example of when I was trying to do that. Silly little song, but I think the poetics of it are very tightly, or the attempt to do it very tightly in that sort of way. And it's up that later on when I, you know, the songs that I did it more deftly, I think, in the songs that turned up on the next album. But, you know, it's a silly little song, but crams a lot of thought and a lot of words into this silly little song.
What about that combination or the time period caught the attention?
I hate to say it because it sounds lame, but it's kind of just that pop punk was such a big deal back then. You know, I mean, every band, Screeching Weasel, The Queers, Gooby Ghoulies, Hi-Fi's, Us. I mean, the Lookout thing, at least in that world, was such a big deal from that. It had that period of time, like, you know, of course, Green Day was the biggest thing at the time, too. So I think that helped, of course. And, of course, you know, Jawbreaker and Sam-I-Am got major label deals. I mean, those records didn't do well. But it was at that thing where pop punk was just the big thing. I don't know exactly what made that lineup work, but that seems to be the one lineup that everybody remembers, which I understand because it was the one that made those records, you know, Love Is Dead and Revenge Is Sweet, and Alcatraz, for that matter, too. So I have my things about, you know, how it was sometimes difficult, you know, for us to all kind of be around each other at that time. And however, it just turned out to be the most, I don't want to say popular, but yeah, the lineup that people kind of remember the most. And at the time, too, we toured a lot. I mean, after Love Is Dead came out. And even before that, we did another tour. I think we did a tour for Women Who Love Them, too. Yeah, so, you know, from that point on, I mean, we were gone a lot. So, you know, we were just everywhere. So, you know, we'd do two or three U.S. tours a year.
Jim, after your metal bands in high school, were there any punk bands that you drummed with before you joined Mr. T Experience?
Right before I joined Mr. T Experience, I was in a real brief lived band called Jolt, which we did a 7-inch for Shredder Records, which was like a Bay Area label here. And that was maybe 6 months. Didn't last very long. I think one of the guys kind of continued on for a while. And then before that, I was in a band called the Slambodians, which is like the worst name ever. But that actually went on for some time. I think we started that in like 86 and, you know, probably into 92.
How did you end up in Mr. T Experience?
You know, after the Jolt thing kind of fizzled out, I was just a drummer without a band. So what I, you know, back then too, you'd put up a flyer at a record store, a music store, and every place I can think of, I would just put up a flyer saying, you know, drummer looking for band, and just put the bands I was into. There's a local chain of music stores here, record stores called Amoeba Records. And, you know, usually within a week, they tear those flyers down, but mine kind of, for some reason, just stayed up there. And Aaron, the bass player at the time from Strategic Experience, saw it and just gave me a call. I was almost ready to give up at that point because everybody who called me up to the point where Aaron called me was just, it was terrible. No one even read the flyer. They would just say, oh yeah, we play Zeppelin covers. It's like, I'm not looking to play in a rock band. I'm going to play in a punk band. So, and of course I was a fan of the Mr. T Experience before they called me. So I was thrilled to get a call from a real band that actually toured and made records. You know, I was a bit nervous kind of going into it, kind of thinking, oh God, I hope I get this gig because I really want it.
Wow. Were you surprised to actually get a phone? Did he say it was from Mr. T when he called you?
He did, yeah. At the time, the band was really on the outs. It was after they did Our Bodies Ourselves, and the drummer quit. So it was just basically Frank and Aaron, and I don't think Lookout had much faith in them at that point. So even when Aaron called me, he said, you know, I'm in this band, the Mr. T Experience, but we're kind of thinking of giving up the name and just calling ourselves something else, like starting a whole new band. And I just said, yeah, whatever, I'll do whatever.
The future ain't what it used to be.
I would nominate that as perhaps the weakest one on the record. There's nothing wrong with it, but I don't know. I don't think it distinguishes itself particularly, and it's one of those things where the idea is maybe better than the execution, writing-wise.
Frank, when you go into the studio, do you stick to the songs you're going to do and they all come out? Like you said, that one's not as good. Why did it end up on the album?
We always had a weakness of not editing. I mean, we'd always piled everything on, and so this is no exception. But if I had gone back, I would have cut a couple songs for sure if I were to go back and do it again. On the other hand, it was kind of in keeping with the general spirit of recording, where we were just presenting a document of what happened during that time in a way. And so, and there were no outtakes at all. These were I had a demo tape of, like, I guess the wheezing happened earlier. I had the demo that it's just me and an acoustic guitar mostly. It was like 50 songs, and these were the ones we chose to do. This time we stuck to the list. We were a lot more loosey-goosey with it for other records, but the chips fell where they did.
I know it weighed on Frank sometimes that he put so much thought and so much energy into perfecting these lyrics, and knowing there's always going to be a certain percentage of our listeners who didn't care or notice one whit.
That was actually one of the reasons I started doing these podcasts. And I realized doing interviews for Even the Blackouts that no one ever really asks about song lyrics. It's strange. I hardly ever was asked about a meaning of a song. I guess sometimes artists don't want to talk about that either, you know, let the song speak for itself. But I'm one of those that likes to talk about the meanings of the songs.
Yeah, you get some pushback sometimes from songwriters, but I think that's mostly people who, on some level, must be a little bit embarrassed at what they're writing and don't want to have to answer for it. But that's not the case at all with Frank. It's almost criminal that Frank doesn't get the recognition that he deserves for the brilliance of the wordplay and the extremely complicated lyrical structures that he comes up with, which really have more in common with Tin Pan Alley greats like Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Ira Gershwin. He has these intricate internal rhyme schemes that just, once you are clued into them, completely make your head spin. And he never cheats a rhyme or even repeats the same chorus twice. He just has so much to say, it's a waste of an opportunity to repeat the chorus. So there's always a slight variation every time. So it's just brilliant craftsmanship. And maybe it was too brilliant to ever have the kind of broad appeal that some bands enjoy, but to me that's really what makes these songs in particular stand the test of time.
Number 9, I Fell For You.
I stand behind that one too. I mean, you know, it's funny looking back on it. If you really look at them one by one, it's better than my impression is. some pretty strong numbers. I mean, I Fell for You is lyrically and melodically and just sort of, you know, energy-wise, it comes off pretty much exactly. I mean, I guess it's a pop song, and it's got some good, you know, weird little figurative language in there. What, you snatched me from the jaws of death, but what have you done for me lately? Those things that still crack me up when I think about it.
I don't know how to phrase this question. I just want to fit this in here because I know myself. I write songs that as I'm writing, the lyrics come out, and then sometimes I work hard on lyrics beforehand, before I have music. Do you use both those approaches and others?
It's not like everything we've done the same way, but almost in every case, I start with a title, and the title usually has a conceit. The good ones are the ones that I find most, you know, satisfying. Has a conceit to go along with it, a little, you know, an organizing gimmick. And then how the song gets constructed is not very systematic or methodical. It's just I like sit there with a guitar and play around with it till it seems like enough of a song to say, okay, I'm going to cut this off, snip this of the general stream of fooling around. I'm going to pinch it here and then start to work on it in more detail. But that's why it takes a long time to write these songs, because there's so much meandering. Then there's a period once you have the kind of the structure of it set where you have to work on, where am I? I have to put some lyrics here. I got to have a line that rhymes with this and that does this. And then that's where there's more of that filling in the lyrics kind of thing. But mostly, certainly for the good ones that I've done, it's kind of more of an organic process that it just kind of gradually sorts itself out after thousands of times of playing it.
But usually starting with a title.
I almost always, a title or a conceit. For instance, I have a song based around a knock-knock joke. So, okay, what would a song be where you would literally narrate the scenario of a knock-knock joke and turn it into a love song? But the only way that would have been written was that I'm going to do this trick. And a lot of them are that way. And, you know, sometimes they work better than others, but when it works, that's my favorite of the songs that I've been. Whoa, I fell for you.
Frank is in the company of quick overturn people like Joe Queer and Ben Weasel. Why did the band stay this consistent for those 4 years?
I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. So I think if you consider this period of the Mr. T Experience to be the high watermark or not, it definitely seems to have had the longest sustained success. I think there's probably three elements that went into that. One is Green Day breaking through 2 years before we recorded Love Is Dead. And that was sort of a rising tide that lifted all boats, especially Lookout Records fans. And I think that MTX may have been total accidental participants in the zeitgeist at that time. It was probably the first and last time, because Frank is totally an iconoclast and he would never intentionally chase any trend. But there was this brief period of time where the world sort of caught up to where he'd been for years and years. And it happened to coincide with it being his most prolific songwriting period, where he really came into his own. And Frank was totally a machine during that period. And like I said, that's when I think he really learned to write to the strengths of the band as a three-piece, which meant these more streamlined arrangements with no guitar solos. And that's also the sound that just happened to be in vogue during that period of time. But if anything contributed to Love Is Dead being a successful record, and then the subsequent 4 or 5 years where I was in the lineup to be the band's most active, I think it's that Frank finally had bandmates who were true believers and were willing to do anything for the cause. Jim is such a great drummer, and he always played to the song and was never trying to show off, which was a complaint that Frank had about the previous drummer, who was really flashy. And then you had me, and I was a solid bass player, and I could sing, I could harmonize, But if I brought one thing to the table, it was that I was as big a Mr. T Experience fan in the world as it was possible to be. And so I was down for whatever the cause was. And because Frank is 13 years older than me and Jim is 10 years older than me, and I was just in my late teens, I think our relationship, the dynamic between me and those guys was maybe as much as I was a disciple or an apprentice as I was an equal. I was with them to the ends of the earth in those 5 years. And I think that's really what it takes to get anywhere. You have to have people who are willing to quit their jobs and drop out of college like we all did and get into a van. And we're having the time of our lives doing it.
Here's a long but exciting section that covers a lot of material, starting off with Kevin Army, a producer and engineer.
What is your relationship with the band Mr. T Experience, and when did it begin?
From the first album, 87, 86. First album was done just super fast. Then, they did the next one with that guy from the Celibate Rifles, and then after that, starting with Night Shift, I was on as producer engineer for the rest of the stuff, pretty much.
Well, that's a simple answer. There you go.
Me and Frank come from a similar perspective of songwriting as a very important thing, and so I think there's a sympathetic relationship there.
When did you start engineering?
I started engineering in probably 86. I'd been producing for a few years and not knowing what I was doing. I think the first stuff I produced came out in 83. First full-length album was Pariah on Posh Boy, which sounds wretched, I think. Probably a pretty good record for a first thing. I learned how to engineer kind of the first few. If you hear some of the earlier stuff, it's pretty questionable. I think the first thing I did that sounded tolerable was the first Mr. T album.
Were they your first experience with the Gilman bands?
Well, they were before Gilman. I mean, what they don't get credit for often is, I mean, they really were the first people around here doing that thing. Punk rock had gone into just being hardcore pretty much around here. And there was a bit of a shift in attitude I was seeing in other bands around the same time. Quickway was another East Bay band. And then there's a mod band, the Undesirables. Yeah, but Mr. T Experience, you know, they were kind of like this breath of fresh air to me because it was back to when I liked about punk rock. And they were probably a year before Gilman, I'm going to guess. I mean, Larry looked me up because of the Mr. T album, and that was the Lookouts album. I think that's probably a little before Gilman, or just as it started. So everyone's entitled to this kind of just before everything.
Everybody's Entitled to Their Own Opinion was released on Disorder Records. I remember that Ben and I both had this record. It was like one of our favorite records. I don't even remember how we got it. But I don't know anything about the label or how you got on it. Can you fill in some of these blanks for me?
Yeah. Disorder Records was originally a record company that John Bon Zelowitz and a couple of his buddies, which included me, not from the very beginning, but shortly after he started doing it. And basically all it was you put an ad in MRR, they'd take orders that would come in the mail, and then this guy Max would go to Rough Trade and get the records wholesale, and then we'd once a week go to John's house and have some beers and put the records in little mailers and send them out. So that was Disorder Records, and that was why it was, you know, ordering the records sort of thing. And then when the time came, when we decided to take our fledgling or sort of pre-fledgling band, and we did a recording that was like over a weekend at the cheapest 8-track studio we could find. And it was, I don't know what everybody else, I sort of imagined it was going to just be a demo, a tape that we'd pass around to people, but John had higher ambitions, so to speak. And so he said, let's make it into a record. And so that's what we did.
And then Rough Trade picked it up.
No, it was the guy, Tom from Boner Records, he agreed to handle the distribution of it. We assembled the record and then dropped him off at his apartment, and then he did what he did with them. And it did get around. I think it got pressed like 4 times or something. So, you know, it's a novelty. It got played on the college radio a bit, and, you know, it got around. I'm not that surprised to find out that some wound up in Chicago. I'm a little bit surprised to find out that 2 separate people who wound up being associated with each other later happened to have it. That kind of seems like quite a coincidence, but it did get around.
Larry Livermore said to me, this is a quote, "I had fought long and hard to bring them to the label. Frank was surprisingly resistant, even though I'd been an early supporter of the band and had known him since before there was an MTX or Lookout Records," unquote. Do you feel this is a fair assessment, and what led you to signing the Lookout Records eventually?
You know, the way that Larry and I started out with putting out records the same way. I mean, we did it, and then, you know, he had his band of Lookouts, and he basically just did the exact same steps. He recorded with Kevin, same place, same, you know, same pressing plant, same cover printer, same distributor, same everything. And then, you know, we had, as it turned out, not super wonderful, but, you know, we were signed to a label before Lookout even existed, which was Left Trade US, which may not have been the greatest label in the world, and it certainly didn't make us stars or anything, but they had a system, you know, they put the records out, they serviced them to radio stations, which is something that when Lookout did start, that just wasn't something Larry was ever interested in doing. So when we would look at it, we would say, well, okay, so we'll have to like buy our own records and mail them to radio stations then. You know, it was like, it just, we had this other situation that may not have been perfect. And, you know, looking back on it now, probably would have been better for the long-term prospects of the project if we had just said, we don't want to do it on Rough Trade. We want to do Larry's Kitchen Table label because of what it became. But at the time, mostly, I mean, I think there were other considerations and other people might have had different things they were thinking about. But to me, it was almost all 100% about the college radio, because John and I were both college radio DJs. We saw that as the important thing. Why are you putting it out if they're not going to play it? You know? I don't know that it came to a point of direct disagreement with Larry. I mean, Larry never, I don't think he made as much of an effort to get us on. I think we had a conversation about it, you know, once or twice. But then when Rough Trade US went out of business, which coincidentally or not, was very shortly after Big Black Bug's EP was released, and we had new stuff and we were recording it and we were, you know, looking for a new label to put it out, and that's how the So Long Suckers 7-inch ended up on Lookout, and then subsequently the album Making Things with Light, and then we just did everything else on Lookout.
So this is goodbye more or less, and things have changed a lot, I guess.
Number 10, Deep Deep Down.
That is a beloved song for people who pay attention to this band and my songs. As presented, it's a bit ambiguous. It's a sort of a dark love song. It actually was loosely based on or sort of steps off from a case of a guy at UC Berkeley back when I was in college who murdered his girlfriend and buried her in a canyon.
Such a mess and so out of hand, though I think it went pretty much as you planned. It was so hazy till my eyes are clear. Now I can see better, but it still looks weird. Is that still you lying there? Why can't I find you anywhere?
I've been asked to play it at weddings and so forth. You know, this is our song, man. This is a little funny, but it has a mysterious power even when people don't know what it's about.
I still don't understand this episode or why you let us down that road, but I think you knew where it would lead and how something would come
out. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this one is because it does have that dark undercurrent, very melodic songs, but if you really think about the lyrics, there is some dark flavor there that I think sells it better than just a regular, you know, poppy album.
And it was tough to read reviews because people who would just listen once and just look at the surface and go, this is another jokey pop punk record. I'm like, boy, he just didn't really read the lyrics. I mean, it's pretty hard to think deep, deep down is a jokey pop punk song.
Was there a point that you remember, it might have been immediately, where they were not just another band, but someone that you wanted to keep working with? Was it just at that first record, or did you sort of grow more and more to keep them under your wing?
I liked the first record. I thought it was really good. I thought Frank was a songwriter who was above a lot of other people. So the time it really hit me was when we were doing Big Black Bugs, the third record. Kind of in the middle of doing the song about the girl who went shopping.
Oh, I love that song too.
This is a song about a girl who went shopping. No, a shopping trip, she bought a pot covered with Teflon for cooking vegetables and things like that. And she bought some punk rock records. And after she bought these things, she took them out and put them in the trunk of her yellow Datsun and drove home.
And I was just like, this guy is just like a great songwriter. That song is as great as anything to me. And especially like the lyrics are great. It's an interesting song. And I think because that was when I was more stepping into the role of producer and trying to push Frank a little bit and understanding that there was this guy who like really had a lot of talent. And from there on, you know, I was always sold that. I mean, every time he'd come up with these songs that just, they're great songs. They should have been big, huge hit.
As time went on, and sort of in spite of myself, I started to care about what I was doing just maybe slightly more. And, you know, as you probably know, it can be kind of challenging psychologically to be in a little band that nobody really cares that much about for a long periods of time. And so I felt as time went on and we kept doing these little records that met with very little approval from anyone, that I kind of didn't have very many allies. And Kevin was one of the only people that encouraged me to keep going and to write better songs and to try to do better things. And sometimes it resulted in experiments that went off half-cocked and things that, where the phrase that was often used at the time was where your reach exceeds your grasp. But that was also something that was interesting because, you know, what a lot of people were doing was, you know, you didn't have any money. You'd go in and you'd spend the least amount and try to hope you'd get away with something that didn't suck, that sounded pretty much like your, like you did when you played live. And I think I probably wouldn't have been interested in doing that for very long. And we didn't have any money either, but Kevin was willing to do crazy things that we couldn't afford to do and see what came out of it, even if sometimes it was a bit iffy. In addition to that, there were times when I was always ready to hang it up, and it was like, okay, this is the last one. I'm tired of doing this, these things that nobody pays attention to. And then he was always, okay, well, we're gonna do this last one, and we're gonna make it count. And then, you know, that was most of the record.
Love Is Dead really takes the band in a more straightforward pop-punk structure, carrying with it both pros and cons, I think. How was Love Is Dead received by the Mr. T audience that had already been around for years?
You could probably delineate the fans of the Mr. T Experience into a pre-Love Is Dead generation and a post-Love Is Dead generation. So I think there's people who stuck with the band from the very early years, starting in the late 80s even, past the point where I joined, but there was such a young audience that came aboard in the mid-90s that a lot of them weren't even aware there was a back catalog. I think the reason why Love Is Dead is so streamlined from an arrangement standpoint is that by that time, Frank had worked out exactly how to write his songs to suit the current lineup of the band. Because for the first 5 years of the band's existence, they were a four-piece with two guitars. And they actually had a lot of guitar heroics going on. Frank's a hell of a guitar player. And there was solos all over the place and shredding and effects pedals. And when they went from a four-piece to a three-piece, I think it took a while for them to find their equilibrium and realize that without the rhythm guitar behind it, the lead guitar heroics didn't work as well. So not only did his songwriting reach an apex from a quality standpoint, but I think he also was writing to the strengths of the band as we were in that period of time. So it was leaner and meaner and more straightforward. And like you said, it's maybe not, I'm not saying if it's better or worse, but it was playing to our strengths. And I think there's a reason why it worked as well as it did. And Love Is Dead in particular, I think, captured the sound of the band in that time. The album is a really cohesive piece of work. And some of that is intentional, and some of that was because of time and budget limitations that we were working with. And I know, for example, that there's a really tight drum sound on that record. And on later albums, the drums got bigger and boomier, which is what Jim preferred. And out of necessity, the guitar sound on Love Is Dead is practically uniform throughout the entire record. So from song to song, it all sounds the same. And I know Frank would have liked more time to be able to dial in different guitar sounds and guitar tones. So there's not a ton of sonic variety on it, but I think in its own way, it's just a perfect snapshot of the band as we were in that particular time and place.
Number 11, Can I Do the Thing?
The origin of it comes from when John Bonn learned to do the thing where you do the sustained or suspended fourth, you know, like Keith Richards thing, right? And so then once he figured that out, every time we would do there was a period where we'd be learning a new song and John would say, "Hey, Frank, can I do the thing on this?" And so that phrase just kind of stuck in my head. I forgot that that was what it was about, but yeah. I don't think it was about, but that was where the phrase came from.
Jim, do you have any memories of the time that you spent in the studio during Love is Dead?
It's hard to say. I know where the record was recorded in Berkeley at this place called Bay Recording Studios or something like that. And I do remember the one thing that sticks in my head, I don't know why, but there was a plaque on the wall somewhere that had it was a gold record award for Grandma Got Ran Over by a Reindeer.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve.
Couldn't even tell you if that song was recorded there, if it was mixed there or something, but I was wondering if that was their claim to fame. Like, there's nothing else on the wall but this one record that they recorded that, you know, as we know, is pretty huge, but terrible.
I had a dream. Somebody was doing something. And I did something.
It went by pretty quickly. Like, we already had the songs pretty much worked out. Frank would just come in with the guitar part, and then as a band, we'd kind of put the song together. But we were pretty well ready to go in. We knew what we were going to do, and I don't think it took very long at all, too. And I think Kevin Army came by to a few rehearsals and kind of had us speed the songs up a little bit, because some of that record, I know Frank mentioned this in the past, too, that they sound a little too fast. Some songs were kind of meant to have a bit of a drag to them, and the record seems to kind of have that same pacing throughout, which is not a bad thing, but it would be good if there was some slower tracks that kind of had a little more slower pacing, so to speak.
Can I do that thing?
Mr. Christopher Applegren, how did you get involved with Lookout Records?
I got involved with Lookout Records as a high school, teenage, punk rock-loving skateboarder that happened to live in the middle of nowhere in Northern California. And I was, up through Maxim Rock and Roll and other fanzines, aware of kind of the vibrant scene that was starting to develop in San Francisco and in Berkeley and Oakland in the late 80s. The Mr. T Experience were definitely, you know, one of those bands, along with Operation Ivy and Isocracy and later Green Day, that sort of preoccupied me. And I did a radio show on a tiny little community station out of a town called Garberville, California, called Wild in the Streets. I actually went and saw Operation Ivy, Isocracy, and the Lookouts play, and Crim Shrine, some of the early Lookout Records bands, at a college in Arcata, California, and met Larry Livermore there. And then I, a couple weeks later, wrote him a postcard and asked if he could send me some promo copies of Lookout Records for my show. And Larry wrote back and suggested that instead of sending me promos, why didn't he come up and be a guest on my show, and he'd bring all the Lookout Records plus a bunch of other cool punk stuff that we could play. And that turned into us co-hosting the radio show Wild in the Streets for, gosh, almost 3 years. And really, I started working at the label, filling mail orders and stuffing 7-inches on the weekends after we did our show at his place in the woods there, too, near Laytonville, California.
Continuing with Christopher Applegren on track 12, I'd Do Anything for You. What is your specific relationship with the band, Mr. T Experience, and when did that begin?
I graduated high school in 1991. I graduated a little bit early, and I moved to Oakland, California, planning to attend UC Berkeley and also to continue working at Lookout Records, which had sort of fully moved to being, even though it had released Bay Area punk bands, actually Larry was sort of splitting his time between Northern California, far up north, and Berkeley. So he moved to Berkeley full time, and I rejoined him there and kind of began working at the label. And Mr. T Experience was, you know, was definitely one of my favorite bands at the time.
Well, you're not here with me, or if there's something I could do to make you wanna be.
I would see their guitar player at the time, John Bond, would come into our little studio, Larry's studio apartment slash Lookout Records office often. Somehow, I don't know, they sort of remained an enigma. And it was actually the period before Love Is Dead where the band seemed to transform, where John Vaughn, of course, left the band. And then Alex, the original drummer, also left. Aaron Rubin, the bass player, also left the band. And it was just sort of like John Vaughn had sort of been the business person who came in and dealt with Larry on band and label-related stuff. And then Aaron sort of took his place when John Vaughn left. And then finally there was, in my mind, kind of nobody left. And that's when I actually started talking to Frank. I think I used to remember seeing him in Berkeley from time to time and, sort of intimidated by him. I'd, you know, maybe wave at him from across the street, but never had the nerve to kind of actually have a conversation with him. And I don't recall him ever actually coming in and doing any band business at the office, you know, prior when there was somebody else that could actually handle that. He really sort of became the band because there was almost nobody else left. I just remember that, you know, almost immediately, I think we were working on the EPs prior to Love Is Dead, and the Woman That Loved Them, and Take It At My Heart, sort of like the CD and vinyl version of that, of Lookout 106, and then Alternative is Here to Stay, the kind of 7-inch EP and CD EP, and that was when Frank and I started working together, with me mostly helping creatively with the album artwork, and it actually was a really satisfying and fruitful process. I had believed that I sort of understood the appeal of the band and loved their music and liked having the opportunity to extend, you know, what they were doing with visual elements, and Frank really seemed to respond to my ideas. So, you know, that was kind of the beginning of both our friendship and also the working relationship and the sort of role that I had with the band. You know, by that record, we had a really good functioning relationship when it came to the mechanics of actually putting the record together with everything else that wasn't the recording, you know.
I had approached Larry about this, and he said he would still talk about it, but he said that you would be a better person. It sounded like he was transitioning out at that period, and you were becoming more of an influence on specifically Mr. T Experience. Do you agree to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's nice for Larry to give me that credit. I mean, I would say that would be the case. You know, he definitely was, you know, this was in the mid-90s, and Larry in general was really transitioning away from the day-to-day decision-making and involvement in the label, having at that time, even for years already, sort of expressed his feeling that it wasn't really the right fit for him and what he wanted to be doing. He still was definitely responsible for the larger decisions, like, you know, things like approving budgets and kind of directional stuff. But in terms of the more day-to-day workings of conceiving of and actually sort of making these records from the label business perspective, I would say that that's definitely true. And I did feel a real specific kind of affinity for the Mr. T Experience. I mean, even at that time, they were one of the few bands that had been a part of the very early Lookout years that was still, you know, the members had changed over the years, were still sort of functioning. A lot of the other bands, of course, had broken up, and maybe their members had formed new bands that we were working with. But really, like, the Mr. T Experience, kind of, for me personally, all the way back to, like, the, you know, 15-year-old punk fan on a skateboard that, you know, kind of fell in love with the label and with the kind of East Bay music scene.
Number 13, Semi-OK.
Semi-OK, I think, is the oldest song. It dates back the furthest. We recorded a demo of it during the same session where we recorded Alternative Is Here to Stay. So it's one of the first songs I ever learned with the band, probably. And as such, it always holds a special place in my heart.
You've seen quite a few incarnations of MTX. At the time, what was your initial reaction to this particular lineup of Frank, Joel, and Jim?
Well, it's great. Going back to the release before it and the Women Who Love Them, when Jim enters the band, they just tightened the band up, thereby making it a lot easier to work with, I think. So, and then you had Joel, which was just a big energy shot, too. Suddenly there was this tighter, more together incarnation of the band that had more energy, had more enthusiasm. They really were excited about being in the band. It was great.
Was there as many backing vocals as there are on Love Is Dead on the earlier ones? The first one, which is one of my other favorites, I don't think has any backing vocals that I can think of.
No, I think, again, for better or for worse, that's probably my biggest contribution to the sound of MTX during the years I was in the band. Because I was a decent bass player who got better and better over my years in the band, but you know, I was a complete novice at playing with other musicians, and I really was learning on the job. But I could sing, and I loved to sing and harmonize, and when I first joined the band, Frank said to me that he'd never played with anyone before who could harmonize. And then, of course, I wanted to do it all the time. So I think that may have gotten old for Frank at a certain point, but I would maybe let the first verse go, and then I would want to harmonize on every line of the song after that. I'd want to harmonize on the first chorus, second verse, bridge. But I think that really became one of the defining elements of the version of MTX that I was a part of, was our two voices blending together.
Alcatraz, released in 1999, was the last MTX album you appeared on. What happened? What change occurred that led to your exit from the band?
I very much didn't want to leave the band, but at the same time, I had started a band of my own at the same time. It was called The Plus Ones, where I was the principal songwriter and singer. I did that because I just always knew this was an unspoken rule, but there was just no room in MTX for a second songwriter or a second singer. Frank was just too prolific. And at that point, he'd well established that he was the driving force behind the band. He'd totally earned that right. I had some songs of my own that I wanted to get out into the world, and I'd always wanted to try my hand at being the front person. We coexisted for a while, both bands, but I think it was almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, because from the moment that I told him that I was going to be starting a side band of my own, I think Frank was worried that that would eventually lead to me parting ways, and maybe he almost looked for a conflict to make that happen. The Plus Ones got an offer to do a tour opening for the Donnas, and I really wanted to do it. And the Alcatraz tour had not gone very well. The album was not being particularly well received with our fan base because it was a little too much of a radical departure for some people's tastes. And I totally believed in the album and Frank's vision for it, but the subsequent touring, the shows we played behind it, were just a little bit less well attended than they'd been. You could tell people weren't enjoying it as much. And at that point, we just had been on the road almost nonstop for the last 5 years. So sometimes there was just little petty flare-ups between band members. It basically just had not been as much fun as it had been previously. Not anything out of the ordinary for a band who's had been living so closely with one another for that amount of time. But I just really wanted to do a fun tour, and I thought that would be a good time. And it conflicted with some shows that the Mr. T Experience had been offered to do for South by Southwest. So I couldn't do both tours, and I wanted to do the Plus Ones tour, and Frank made it an ultimatum. He said if I did the one tour, I couldn't continue on. And I respect his position for that. I wish that he had maybe found a fill-in bass player for those dates. And who knows, maybe we could have kept going for a little while longer. Maybe my exit was premature. I sort of felt like my hand was forced. But of course, I had the choice. I could have passed up the one tour to do the other. But that's the delineation point right there. And there, at the time, there were no hard feelings, but unfortunately, it was a pretty clean break. And after that, we didn't remain as close as I would have liked, unfortunately. It wasn't dramatic. You know, I went over to Frank's apartment and we had a very civilized discussion of it. And it only got maybe a little emotional at the end where I said, you don't have to do this. And he said, did you ever just consider not going on the tour that will conflict with ours? And I said, I honestly hadn't. So maybe that was my answer right there. You know, I know he was disappointed in me because the album was at a critical make or break point, and me leaving made it seem as if the band didn't stand behind our work to a certain extent, and that I had made a promise that I would stick with them through all the touring that needed to be done behind that. So I think he felt like I let him down, and I felt like maybe he wasn't being flexible, and we're probably both a little bit right. I don't know what would have happened if I'd stayed in the band. It's possible that things would have kind of wound down over the next year or two anyway. I mean, the kind of music that we were making was no longer the flavor of the week. And I don't know if we would have been able to continue to tour enough to pay our bills. But who knows what would have happened. I think if you'd asked me 12 months after I parted ways, I would have definitely said that I regretted it. And there's been times where I would dearly have loved to have reteamed with those guys, but there was just no looking back at that point.
I'm like, yeah, but she's all no.
That's the one I was talking about. It was probably recorded a little too fast. There's something about the feel of that on the record that it just sounds sped up. I don't know what it is about it, but it does sound weird when it kind of loses the feel that it should have. I think that song should have been slower.
Yeah. I think what's interesting what you said earlier is it's hard once you're in concert even to play slower. Did you have to make a concerted effort on your part to say to yourself, I'm going to slow this down?
Yeah, because Frank would start that song off. That was his, because he started off. And so I never knew how he was going to play it. So was he going to play it fast? Was he going to play it slow? So I really had to listen to what he was doing to go, okay, you just sort it out and we'll just kind of go from your lead. So, and I always would have Frank blaring in my monitors to make sure that I can hear what he's doing. So when we get to that song, if we played it live, you know, and he wanted to just, I mean, sometimes he would slow it down to just a crawl. And I was just like, okay, fuck, man. I'm going to be a dick and I'm going to speed it up a little bit. So.
So you went from playing in bands that were just mostly staying in the Bay Area, California, to being all over the world, basically.
Yeah, that was a bit of a transition, too. I mean, I have type 1 diabetes, too, so, I mean, it never got to be an issue about playing. We never had to cancel any shows or anything like that, too, but, you know, just kind of being away from my usual routine. It, you know, of course, you know, you're gone. You know, you can't, nothing's normal. Your sleep habits are screwed up. Your eating schedule screwed up. It's, everything is off, as you know, just when you tour. Nothing can be as it was when you're home. So just for that alone, that's the reason why I couldn't continue touring anymore, is just because my health was kind of starting to wane a bit. I mean, we ate so much bad food back then, too. You know, I'm surprised. Like, you know, of course, you can eat McDonald's or whatever else you can. But just, I always just tried to make sure that my blood sugar was somewhat in control to play. But I had a couple pretty bad things happen. You know, one time in Europe, and I think it was in Liverpool, it was after we played, and some kids took me to the cavern area where the Beatles, you know, started and everything. I was just starting to lose track of where I was. My blood sugar was just kind of dropping out, and it was bad. These kids had to carry me back to the van because I couldn't. I just collapsed. Sometimes I wouldn't pay attention, like check my blood sugar and, you know, just kind of go off and do whatever. And then, but it's also scarier, too, when you're not even in America. So it's like, well, Jesus Christ, I have to go to an emergency. You know, here's 3 a.m. and God knows where. But, you know, the good thing is that never had to happen. If I did have, you know, some kind of thing, we were able to handle it pretty well, you know. But it never interfered with the show, which was the main thing, and just to make sure that I can kind of get through it. But, and there was a couple times towards the end of the set, I can tell that I was starting to kind of
I wasn't thinking about the songs. I was starting to lose my head. When your sugar drops out, you know, you just start to almost kind of lose consciousness, and then that's what was happening. So, you know, of course, when you get the glare from the guitar playing the bass, you're like, okay, I'm not doing something right here. I don't know what it is. But the good thing is that we never had to, for as much as we played back then, especially from, you know, say 95 to 99, well, we were able to kind of still not have to cancel shows and that sort of thing, too. So it was good.
Track 15, That Prozac Moment, with Kevin Army.
Did you just, with open arms, take in the addition of a backing vocalist now?
Well, there were always backing vocalists. It was a struggle to rein in Joel on the backing vocals. He's great. He was excited, and he was young, and he wanted to sing over everything. And actually, that is with us cutting him down, cutting the amount that he's singing down a little bit. It's one of those dual things. It's part of what makes the record awesome, and sometimes it detracts from what the emotion of the song's supposed to be. So it's tough to accept sometimes, but also that kind of adds to the effect. For me, there's a lot of pain on that record, but people always take it as a happy record. It adds to that duality. Sometimes helps the perception that it's just a happy, jokey record. Like, I went back and listened to it yesterday, and That Prozac Moment is kind of a devastating song to me, and he's like, you know, singing Happy Buddy Holly stuff. But that's good, too.
I know you're upset with me, but that's just how I choose. Because I don't have the energy to make up an excuse.
Kevin Army, what is the Mr. T Experience?
A great band with a great songwriter that pioneered a sound that doesn't get credit for it. It became a vehicle for Dr. Frank to write these great songs and put it out there in the world. I still have a dream that someday, just like when the Farrelly brothers dug up Jonathan Richman and put him in a movie, someday someone's going to do that for Frank, which might happen because of his book. So I still have faith that that catalog is someday going to reach a broader audience. I could be easily wrong, but I still hold out hope.
Christopher Abelgren, what is the Mr. T Experience?
The Mr. T Experience is the music of Dr. Frank's mind, which is, in my opinion, a very strange and interesting place with the periodic commercial breaks.
What kind of emotions does it bring up with you to think back to those days in MTX?
Yeah. Well, it was completely life-altering for me to join this band and to make this record. I have no idea what kind of person I would be or where I'd be in my life right now if I hadn't met Dr. Frank at Gilman Street that night and we hadn't gone down this path together. So sometimes it's almost a little frightening to look back on it because there's a clear before and after. The trajectory of my life was on before that and where I am today, and it was such a big bang, I can't even begin to speculate how different life would be for me if these things hadn't happened. But it's every emotion you can imagine. You know, I'm a super sentimental person, and this was such a heady time. You know, I'm just a kid out of high school for the first time, living away from home, and everything was so exciting and the possibilities were endless. And that's what the sound of Love's Dead is for me. Still, just the world's a vast open expanse and anything and everything is possible.
So lastly, You're the Only One.
That was the last one written for this record, and I think it's got some great lines, and the irony and the bitterness, which is both expressed by the narrator, the singer, directly and literally, but also is an undercurrent of parody. That's one of the ones that I've always thought has worked pretty well as a song. And then the thing of having it end in a big band comes in and a big crazy fade out, that's a cheesy thing to do. That's something that lots of bands have done, but we never did it before. And I thought it would be kind of a surprise because, you know, we'd gotten into the habit of doing an acoustic song on every record since Our Bodies, Ourselves. I think that's what, you know, the idea is, okay, that's what we'll expect, and then there'll be something slightly surprising. And it was, we actually made some effort to make that outro sonically very different from everything else in the record. I don't know if anybody ever noticed that, but it was like leaving it in this on a suspended note or something. Maybe that sounds kind of cheesy, but that was an idea.
You're the only one for me. I tell you 3 or 4 times a day. When you're with me, I'm happy. I'm lost and lonely when you're
the word sellout is used way too much, and a fan doesn't really know that. A band member knows if they're choosing a music because of, you know, popularity or because they're moving in that direction. But it did seem like there was a big change in the structuring of your writing towards more of a pop-punk feel. Do you think that was just natural in your progression?
It's certainly the reason why the record that followed up, Love is Dead, wound up being essentially the same approach to arranging and stuff. I mean, it was like, I disagreed with it at the time, maybe, you know, because I had other ideas, I had other ambitions. But, you know, at the time it was like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, which I find that's a terrible attitude when it comes to art, though it's a probably pretty good attitude when you've got something that's commercially viable. But the thing that I wanted, really starting with, although you probably can't hear it or notice it very easily, but starting earlier, like with Our Bodies, Ourselves, I was interested in the arrangements and in the recording and this, you know, doing interesting things there as much as we could, but I was mostly wanting to make the songs more speak for themselves. And in fact, when it seemed around the time of The Women Who Love Them, when that was sort of the lowest point of the band as a band, the bass player was scheduled to quit right after doing the bass tracks on it. And we had a very low budget that got reduced and reduced and reduced. And I tried pretty hard on those songs. But what I was imagining would happen with my songs was I was going to just do them solo, and all the Love is Dead songs, and to a lesser degree, possibly the Women Who Love Them songs, they were going to be done as like solo folk songs. And then we had a rock band at the time, and we had a chance to record at a real studio. So it was, okay, well, let's do these. I think that's why, especially for those two records, the arrangements were pretty stripped down. You know, they were taking these little short blasts of best kind of songs, quay songs that I could come up with and putting them in punk rock form. As time went on, though, there's a lot of pressure to do what everybody else is doing. And so, yeah, we kind of, I don't know, veered into that. We probably should have, for commerce sake, probably should have recorded a third one of those. But I was done after the second one. And so, for better or worse, whatever that more generic pop punk machine, which I wouldn't say it's generic because the songs were, not to say they were the most wonderful thing in the world, but they were something that for better or worse, no one else could have done. And I don't say that as like that's there necessarily, it's the greatest thing to try to do, but it was the thing that distinguished it from all the other people who were doing it. And, you know, we were never at the top of the heap by any means, but it was a lot more viable at the time. So you get something that works and you run with it as long as you can. And it turned out that I could run with it for 2 albums.
You're the only one.
What is the Mr. T experience?
It's Dr. Frank. It's it's songs about girls.
Thank you very much for listening to the 9th episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring Mr. T Experience's 6th album, Love is Dead. Stay tuned for episode 10, which is the record Scandal in Bohemia by the Northampton band known as The Jazz Butcher. A million
miles an hour. Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.